Our next speaker today is Dr. Michael Radu. He's a senior fellow and co-chairman of the Center on Terrorism, Counterterrorism, and Homeland Security at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Dr. Radu.
Thank you. In the time of Philadelphia Society, although I seem to be the only person actually from Philadelphia here today, but that's just a coincidence. Let me start by saying that I'll discuss a bit the ideological aspects of what is now fashionably called the socialismo del siglo XXI, which is the official ideology of Chavez and Morales, and to some extent is subscribed to officially by Ortega and Correa. And to give you a flavor, I'll quote two sentences from an address Evo Morales sent to a meeting of solidarity with Bolivia, which took place in Ciudad de Guatemala 2 days ago. Si queremos salvar al planeta Tierra para salvar la vida y la humanidad, estamos en la obligación de acabar con el sistema capitalista. Los graves efectos del cambio climático, de las crisis energéticas, alimentarias y financieras, no son producto de los seres humanos en general, sino es del sistema capitalista vigente, inhumano, con su desarrollo industrial ilimitado. And then he goes further and says, as an example of what's wrong, respecto a la madre tierra, el sistema capitalista trae a la madre tierra como una materia prima, pero la tierra no puede ser entendida como una mercancía. ¿Quién podría privatizar o alquilar, fletar a su madre? Propongo que organicemos un movimiento internacional en defensa de la madre naturaleza para recuperar la salud de la madre tierra y restablecer la vida armónica y responsable con ella. Well, that would take more time than I have. I'm sorry, I can do it afterwards. But I assume that most people here understand. Anyway, let me put it this simply. Because all the problems in the world could be solved if we finish off the capitalist system. Climate change. In energy crisis, food crisis, financial crisis are not products of just about every human being, but of a certain system, of reigning capitalism, which is inhuman, and particularly because of its unlimited industrial development. The second part is about Mother Earth. I'm not going to translate more, but if you are aware of some of the more extreme statements of inhabitants of Berkeley, California, about Mother Earth, you get the thrust. Well, what is important here is less the ravings of a person with less than high school education. Although education, to be sure, is not necessarily the most important thing in a president's economic policies. Sometimes too much education, as you may see in this electoral campaign in this country, may hurt you in terms of your economic understanding. The problem here is that everything Morales says coincides with a lot of the thinking of elites in Europe, and I may say in the United States, which explains why this kind of radical leftism, which doesn't dare to mention its own name, that's why it's called socialism, not Marxism, and of the 21st century, it's a projection in the future, allegedly, it's supported in Europe and in this country at a certain levels, and universities are not the only place, political parties. Some very important political leaders are supportive of these kind of ideas because they mix Ecologism, the myth of the noble savage, everything associated with Indians, it's good no matter what it is. So it was already mentioned this morning about the noble savage, but it goes beyond that. Everything Indian is good. And therefore, when these kind of things are being said by an Aymara Indian, they have to be very good. So what Morales is saying and doing is empowering the poor people, the Indians, has to be good. And one of the most prominent leaders of the business community in Bolivia is called Martinkovic, I think. Then it has to be bad, because that name sounds like Croat, and that immediately reminds people, and Morales uses that in his public propaganda, of genocides or alleged genocides in Yugoslavia and all that. So you understand that one difference between this kind of Marxism, which it is, and the old-fashioned one, a la Fidel, is that they are far more wise and skilled at public relations, both at home and abroad. Second, they have learned certain lessons from the experience of Allende in particular. Allende remains the hero of this kind of persons, and also of the experience of the Sandinistas, who lost an election in 1990 and lost power for a while. They also learned that the best way to obtain and retain power is by having it legitimized by elections, no matter what kind of elections. And these are things which distinguish this form of radicalism from the old variety. In addition, it has an element which is directly in contradiction with Marxist-Leninist theory, which is racism. Let's not hide it. What is happening in Bolivia is an attempt by Morales to impose what amounts to a racial dictatorship, taking advantage of the fact that the majority of the population is Indian. Whether he will succeed or not remains to be seen. It is quite clear, though, that in at least certain areas, La Paz included, he is succeeding. In others, like in Chuquisaca, where an Indian woman was elected governor recently as an opponent of Morales, he failed. But we shall see. But that's the intention. And this is something which goes beyond what it was the traditional theme in Latin American intellectual thinking, some kind of romantic view of history, especially pre-Columbian history. Morales openly and repeatedly says that what he wants is historical revenge for the conquista. In other words, that Bolivia belongs to people who are not European. And he even protested to the European Union when that organization talked about restricting illegal immigration from, among other places, Bolivia, by reminding the Europeans that they, the Indians, have accepted European immigrants. In other words, now is the time for the Europeans to pay back and accept all the unskilled and unemployed which Morales and his policy are creating in Spain, for instance, because the majority are going to Spain. And it may work, once again, considering the nature of the Spanish government, for instance. Another aspect which is repetitive in many ways is the anti-Americanism. Now, anti-Americanism, I'm not going to dwell too much into that, because it's probably more popular as a sport than soccer is in Latin America. And it goes across the political spectrum. But in these particular cases, that is used with an intensity which was not very common for about two decades. And sometimes it becomes ridiculous, just as the other one, the Indian. For instance, this idea that America should be Indian, Latin America, or America should be Indian, and therefore get rid of European and American influences, was also used by Chavez in his inimitable manner when he suggested recently that the name of Latin America, America Latina, should be changed into America India, which suggests that there is a problem with the mental process of Chavez, because America is a European term from a European name, so he only understood the second part as being European. But it gives you an idea of what the intention is, to assume that capitalism, exploitation, industrialization are all imports imposed from Europe or the United States, which is the same, and therefore should be rejected. And one way of rejecting that is by using the racial element. It is the same kind of tactic which was tried and almost succeeded in the case of Peru in the last presidential election, when a candidate heavily subsidized by Chavez, Humala, almost won the presidency. And the question is, to what extent this kind of regimes could be expected to survive or expand? So far, we have to say that things are going in their favor. The behavior of the only country in the region that could make a difference, Brazil, is so narrow-minded so far that as long as Lula remains president, which is another 2 years or so, probably that won't make any difference. On the other hand, Chavez has engaged in something like a $7 billion arms procurement campaign. Most of them did not yet arrive. But when they do, Venezuela will have the largest submarine fleet, will have probably the most advanced air force in South America. That is not something which helps Brazilian generals sleep well. In addition, we have Morales fighting and, in fact, nationalizing, in part at least, Petrobras properties. That's a semi-state-owned company, the largest in Brazil. Correa is, in fact, throwing out a Brazilian construction company with big losses for that company. So when you put together this, Brazilian military fears or anxieties and Brazilian business unhappiness with Morales and with Chavez, it's possible that Brazil's attitude may change. On the other hand, Paraguay has a former liberation theology priest as president, and it's unclear which way he will go, but probably not in the direction closest to Milton Friedman in his economic policies. Finally, there is another element which is the most important and most disturbing in all these cases and a few others, which is the total ineptness of the opposition. The Venezuelan opposition is a case study of how not to oppose somebody and how not to do things. In the case of Nicaragua, we know that two-thirds of the Nicaraguan electorate voted against Ortega. But the deal between the former president and Daniel Ortega, which was mentioned already, was strong enough to have two conservative candidates running, so that by obtaining a relative majority of a third of the vote, Ortega became president. Whose fault is that? Not the electorate, but the opposition leadership. Of course, you've noticed that so far I didn't mention the United States at all. And that was because I'm a realistic person. In other words, I didn't mention what doesn't exist. Because the influence of the United States during this administration has gone to levels so depressing, if you want, as I don't remember or read since the Great Depression, when there were other things in the mind of Washington. But at least then there was a clear reason. This situation started with the Clinton administration, which had no interest in foreign affairs whatsoever, and continue with this one, which cannot walk and chew gum at the same time. And therefore, it just chew gum in the Middle East, or regarding the Middle East. How much things would go, I don't know. And I'm trying to be an analyst, not a prophet. Therefore, I'm not going to say more about what's going to happen in the next administration, except that if McCain wins, things would perhaps marginally improve. If not, we may go back to the situation in which we'll make things worse, just as it happened in the Jimmy Carter administration, for one particular reason, among others. And that reason is the fact that the words human rights have been completely hijacked by the left in Latin America. Everything they desire is a human right. Everything they oppose is a violation of human rights. The terms have lost all meaning in reality, but not in Washington, which only probably reinforces most of your opinions that there is a distinction between Washington and reality in general. But that reality remains, and a democratic administration would probably encourage precisely the remaining opposition elements in a number of countries. I'll give you one example. Colombia, Senator Piedad Córdova is, for all practical purposes, the main legal ally of the FARC in political and strategic matters. She's also openly a very good buddy of Chavez. And, of course, they go together. She is the most vocal, not particularly significant, but the most vocal opponent of President Álvaro Uribe. What is the result of that in Washington? Well, I've seen 2 days ago or so a picture of Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, Piedad Córdoba, and the best friend FARC has in the U.S. Congress, Senator McGovern of Massachusetts. A very interesting trinity, and very discouraging for those who live in Latin America and those who care about it. So I'll stop here.
Thank you. Well, gee, Dr.